Hello, everyone, and welcome to CERAWeek Conversations by IHS Markit. I'm Lance Ugla. I'm the host today. I'm the CEO of IHS Markit, and it's a pleasure to be here. And today I'm with David Solomon, the CEO of Goldman Sachs. David, thanks for joining me today.
Well, thanks, Lance, and thank you for having me. And I hope you know all that are watching are staying safe and healthy.
I think it was January when we saw each other last, away on a business trip, and just so many things have changed since then. And I don't think either of us could write a script that would describe what we've experienced in the last 10 weeks. To get started with our conversation, I want to ask you a leadership question. What adjustments to your leadership methods and style have you made in managing Goldman Sachs through this period?
It certainly is, as you said, if I think back to when we were last together in January, you certainly could not have written a script with respect to how we'd all be living and how the pandemic would affect us. But I think we're all adjusting quite well. And I think one of the most important things that we think about as we continue forward from here is striking the right balance. It's a hard thing to do. We've been very, very focused. This first and foremost is a humanitarian crisis. It's a health crisis. We have to take care of people. We also need to make sure we continue to participate in economic activity because economic activity keeps people healthy. And so I've been spending a lot of time thinking about how to get our organization focused on three simple things that I think really matter at a time like this that can keep everybody managing forward. And I do think one of the things that's important from a leadership perspective at a time like this is that you communicate a lot, you communicate clearly. And so at Goldman Sachs, we've been talking a lot about taking care of our people. We've been talking about taking care of our clients. And we've been talking about taking care of our communities and making sure as an organization that we're communicating around those three pillars and finding ways to do as much as we can to move forward. I know we'll get beyond this healthcare crisis. The result of the healthcare crisis has been a significant economic slowdown around the world, and we're going to have to get through the healthcare crisis and then also navigate through the economic crisis. And we're trying to do our small part to make that happen.
Right, right. Well, I know you care a lot personally about philanthropy, and your firm has been such a great supporter for all aspects of the world and challenges the world's faced. What are some of the things Goldman Sachs is doing in the communities to, you know, help us through this crisis?
Well, there are some things at a high level that we're incredibly committed to, particularly support for small businesses. And I should talk about that a little bit. But then there are lots of small things that we're trying to do in all the communities that we operate around the globe. We have about 180 offices in 45 countries. And in the context of that, we try to find ways, you know, very small ways to make a difference. I'll give you one that's an example right here in New York, just because I participated last week. The Northwell Hospital System is one of the large hospital systems here. And we've tried to set up hydration stations and also create a partnership with restaurants that are stressed right now. We're basically paying them to produce food that we're then delivering to frontline healthcare workers. So it's a win-win in that it keeps these restaurants open and employed and going, and it's getting food to frontline healthcare workers. And I went out to Long Island last week to make some sandwiches and participate and say hello to the small business, which is, you know, I'll call that a micro example. At a higher level, we've been very, very supportive of small businesses, you know, broadly, especially in the United States and in the UK, through a program called 10,000 Small Businesses for over a decade. And I think that this is an area where we can use this platform to really make sure capital is getting to small businesses, especially the very small businesses that don't have access to banks and financial institutions and support. This is particularly true in what I'll call underserved communities where the financial infrastructure isn't the same. And so we're trying to get our capital out in loan form to these micro businesses in the United States. We work through community development financial institutions, but both in the US and the UK, you know, we're trying to find ways that we can use our balance sheet, our capital, and our intellectual capital to help these small businesses. And many of them have 3, 4, 5, 7 employees. These are super small businesses that are just very, very stressed right now, and they support families. And it's important that we try to find ways to bolster them up. And that's a broad
goal. Fantastic. Oh, that's great. Well, I know you do a lot, both professionally and within your own life personally. So, you know, thanks for sharing that. You know, thinking back, credit markets played a part earlier in our careers, and if I remember discussing that with you before, you know, you've been through probably the 87 crash, the dot-com, the long-term capital markets, Russia, you know, all the different crises, 2008, of course. How do you compare the response this time to some of the past responses, especially 2008 financial crisis? Do you see any differences?
Well, there are a lot of similarities and there are differences. I'd make a couple of comments. First, I think central banks and governments around the world have responded very quickly to try to dampen the economic impact of the crisis. And I think successfully, and I think laudably, especially with respect to the speed that they've responded. I think that there are significant parts of the playbook of response that's similar to the financial crisis, but I think there are some differences too. And one of the biggest differences, it's happening very quickly. I think one of the reasons why it can happen more quickly, and I'll say in the United States, just for starters, is that in the 2008 financial crisis, financial institutions were at the center of it. There were issues around lending and bad practices that played a role in exacerbating that. I think the way it's sometimes portrayed doesn't fully take in the complexity and the scope of what happened broadly. But here you have a situation where it's affecting everyone in a very even-handed way. And it's hard, you can point blame with respect to preparation and preparedness, but it's hard to point blame for the pandemic. And so there's not the political blockage to getting that monetary and fiscal stimulus moving. And so I think that governments have been very, very quick and swift to get monetary and fiscal stimulus going. And that's helped significantly in calming markets, opening markets, and allowing markets to function, you know, very smoothly. I think there's a real benefit to that. I think as we go forward, we're going to start to get into the debate, which I think is appropriate. Governments can't underwrite all the economic pain that's caused by the decrease in output. And so we've got to find the right balance as we move forward between protecting people and keeping people healthy, being compassionate, but also being pragmatic about the fact that we need economic activity to also keep people healthy. And right. So now that we're through the first stage of this, I think policymakers are going to have very, very difficult decisions as they try to strike that balance. But one of the things that's very, very interesting is, of course, the fiscal policy has an impact on markets and companies, but also on individuals. It does filter down to individuals. The monetary policy certainly starts by having an impact on markets and asset prices and exacerbates a little bit of the divide. Some of that trickles down, obviously, through investments and savings and pensions. But there's no question that we're going to have to find the right balance as we move forward. But I think it's been laudable that governments have moved quickly. And I do think right now we're supposed to be doing everything that we can. That is the role of government. And we will have to deal with the consequences of that when we get to the other side. I mean, there will be consequences and difficult decisions to make when we navigate forward.
Right, right. I really feel, sitting here in Europe, that the government's moved at a pace, you know, that hadn't been seen before, and very impressive decision-making on the behalf of the political establishment. Moving to energy, and, you know, CERAWeek conversations, CERAWeek's, you know, really starts with energy and energy transition and shifting towards climate. But, you know, Goldman Sachs also has a big tradition, you know, the Jay Aron merger years ago in energy. So what's your feel inside of such, you know, your important firm in the financing of those markets and the trading in those markets, the OPEC Plus agreement, negative oil prices? What does it mean for the energy markets going forward? Do you see a return to normal?
Well, do I see a return to normal? I don't know what normal is when you're talking about commodity prices, Lance. Certainly you've seen and I've seen, you know, we've both seen over long periods of time, you know, imbalances in commodities. And you know, what we have right now is we've got an imbalance. There certainly was action by certain market participants coupled with a massive demand shutdown. And it was, you know, it was a very interesting time to take an action that would put pressure on supply, you know, right at the time that we're having a massive demand shutdown, but that's basically what we had. And we're also at a place where we're running out of storage capacity. And therefore there's only one thing to do, which is cut production until you get supply and demand into balance and you free up storage capacity. And that obviously puts an enormous amount of downward pressure on prices. I think what happened with the settlement in the April futures, or the May future, is really just a micro imbalance at a moment in time due to activity around that settlement. And I don't think that's a regular occurrence, but it's not the first time that you've basically seen an imbalance like that force, you know, very, very unusual price action in the short term to settle out a contract. But broadly speaking, there's going to be enormous pressure on the price of the commodity here until we get supply and demand in balance. And given the economic picture of the world, that's going to take some time.
Right. No, I agree. And as you, you've got a great franchise in Asia, China, you know, starting to move in some areas to a post-COVID environment, lockdowns coming undone a little bit, not completely. Other parts of Asia, Korea, Hong Kong, Singapore, all moving at different paces, but definitely ahead of the rest of the world. Are you seeing any economic activity from your seat that says there's a start of economic growth coming back that may give us hope to follow the same path here?
So Lance, there's no question that economic activity is picking up. It is, as you say, market by market, as you look across Asia, but there's no question that I look at our footprint, which obviously spans across Hong Kong and China and Korea and Japan and Singapore. They're all in different places, but they're generally ahead of the trajectory of the United States. In Hong Kong this week, we had about 30% of our employees in the office. My guess is we'll get to about 50% there in the coming weeks. Our colleagues in Hong Kong, they're in restaurants, they're out, they're on the beaches. And you know, I would say after a long haul, and you have to remember Hong Kong was also very disrupted by the protests, you know, in the fall. After a long haul, there's some, you know, sense of normalcy returning in Hong Kong, but with caution, certainly. And I think there are a number of things that have helped there. I think one of the things that's just very, very interesting that's helped, and I think we'd be in a very, very different place in the United States and Europe, masks are part of the culture there. And, you know, everyone wears masks there. They have, and they did. They did at the beginning, they did through the crisis, and we were just very late to that in the Europe and the US. And I think that, you know, I think that made a big difference. It's not that we would have alleviated this entirely, but as this was starting back in February, if people had started wearing masks, there would have been a different impact on the way this scaled, particularly in the New York area, where millions of people were coming from Europe, you know, on flights into New York, which is really, I think, the key reason why New York's been such an epicenter. Right. But there's no question when I talk to companies like Nike and Apple, you know, that are operating in China, they would say their foot traffic is back to 80 or 90%. They would say their, you know, their business is not quite what the foot traffic is, but it's ramping up. Starbucks, et cetera. You're seeing an improvement in economic activity, and it's encouraging. Now, we're in a very different place, you know, in the United States. We also have different protocols. I had a partner of ours head back to Hong Kong, who lives there and operates there just, you know, a week or two ago. And, you know, you arrive, you have to go through a process of getting tested before you can leave the airport. You have to come back with a negative test. You then get an arm bracelet and you have to go quarantine for 14 days. And the arm bracelet, you know, tracks where you are to let everybody know that you are in your place of residence quarantining. So those are precautions that in Western Europe and the US, we're not going to see. So we're going to have to figure out how we're going to strike the right balance in these markets of navigating getting economic activity going while protecting those that are vulnerable from the virus, and continuing to do some of the things we're doing that are helping.
Right. Yeah, no, I'm seeing the same thing with our offices in Asia. And Hong Kong's really impressed me in terms of, you know, the people and how they've responded. And, you know, I'm sure you're finding that with some of your colleagues, how they talk about going to work, going out for dinner, things that they accept as normal, getting a temperature test, signing a waiver as you go into a restaurant, you know, wearing masks religiously when they're out on the street. I've been really impressed with watching how it all has unfolded. And I hope that, you know, we see some of that start to come into some of our cities that maybe haven't been hit as hard as the cities you and I live in London and New York, which I think are going to require additional measures and time to get to that same stage. As you think about this whole period that we've been through now, what surprised you most about your colleagues? If you look back on it, you'll say, geez, I was really surprised that that's what we did at Goldman Sachs. What was that surprise to you?
Well, I'm incredibly proud of the people of Goldman Sachs for their nimbleness, their flexibility, their agility, their resilience, you know, through this crisis. If we were talking, you know, back in January when we were last together, and that was right at the time that this was just popping up in Asia and we were starting, you know, to keep people working from home in Asia. If you had said to me, you know, do you think this is going to spread around the world? And if it does, can we get all of our people working from home? I would have told you, I don't know how we'll do it. There's no way we can get, you know, most of our people working from home, but we're between 98 and 99% of our people operating remotely. The fact that we're operating our big trading businesses remotely is a real testament to the flexibility, resiliency, adaptability of our people. And they've done a good job navigating through that. So I'm surprised by how flexible the organization is. I'm thankful for how prepared we were on so many fronts, which allowed us to accelerate, you know, very quickly to that. And I'm humbled, you know, to be leading a group of people that's really energized and motivated and focused on each other, focused on our clients, focused on our communities at a time that they're all having a difficult, you know, struggle. Right. And so that's, you know, for me, that's incredibly encouraging about Goldman Sachs.
Well, as a customer and also a, you know, a supplier to Goldman, I can tell you all your people have been excellent to deal with, and it's amazing how we adjust and work in new ways together. So, you know, that's great to know.
People are resilient, and
yes,
you know, people are resilient, society's resilient. It's one of the reasons to be very optimistic when we do get to a place that we can make people secure, that they're safe and they're healthy. It's a reason to be very optimistic as to what follows.
Right. I was preparing earlier this morning for, we have Mental Health Week here in the UK and Unity Week coming up, and I'm sure you've been thinking about that as well. Any thoughts on how you're dealing with mental health issues, what you're doing as a CEO, and any advice for others you see are things that are really helping?
Well, I mean, first, you know, and I know you feel the same way, Lance, you know, my heart goes out to all the people that are really affected by this and aren't, you know, in a position where they have an organization like Market or Goldman Sachs, you know, to help them and provide resources and support. And there are so many people that are struggling and need help. And so all of us have to find ways to support those in communities that are so affected by this. But mental health's a real issue, and it's a significant issue, as you highlight, before we came into this, but it's also an impact of the economic damage that we're causing by the action that we've taken. And this is a challenge for all of us, but many have said to me in the last month or two, this is unprecedented. And the actual reality is it's not unprecedented. Pandemics occur. There have actually been 4 global pandemics in the last 100 years. There have been many regional pandemics. Pandemics occur. What's unprecedented is the way we're responding. And we, there are a whole variety of reasons for that. And some of them, especially initially, I think were really appropriate. I think issues and risks, both in Western Europe and here with respect to the healthcare system and overrunning healthcare systems, which could do real damage, was very, very important that we got a handle on that. And I think we have. But now that we have to find a way to strike the right balance in getting people back to work and getting people to participate, because the damage we'll do from a mental health perspective, if people are out of work, if people are isolated, you know, maybe more than the damage that we do, you know, with the virus. And of course, this is a balance and there aren't easy issues, but we've got to find a right way to provide support to people. And I do think one of the things that we can do in an organization like ours is we can provide resources, we can provide tools, we can provide advice, we can let people know that everyone's different. There are people that are young and have no other responsibilities, and they have more flexibility to be very absorbed with work. And there are others that are juggling caring for parents, caring for children, homeschooling children. They have family members that are sick. They have both spouses working, and you know they need more flexibility. And you've got to offer that flexibility and offer that support and make sure people know they have avenues to ask for help through the organization when they need it, and that it's granted in an appropriate way. And I think that helps from a mental health perspective enormously. That security, I think, makes a difference. That doesn't mean there's not going to be a meaningful increase in mental health issues because of this, but that's something as a society, both the public and the private sector, we're all going to have to take on.
Right. Yeah, no, I really feel being aware, not being judgmental, empathy, all the things adding to what you've said, you know, I agree with, and I think this is a time that with the week coming up, we can reflect on it and really engage with our people. One last question before a fun one. I reread your op-ed piece in the FT around sustainability and climate change, and I'm passionate, you know, as I think about, you know, father of four and leading a company that can make change and participate in change. As you look at the climate agenda that we were on, and I think a lot of people didn't feel energy transition and change in general is ever moving fast enough, but has the pandemic altered your view in terms of that pace of change? Are we going to speed up post COVID-19, or do we retrench to a place that is less than where we started from?
So I referenced my op-ed in the Financial Times. You know, I talked broadly about the sustainability platform that we emphasize at Goldman Sachs, and climate is a part of it. But, you know, broadly, we talk about sustainability in a much broader context, and it includes a range of things, including climate, but it includes affordable and accessible healthcare. It includes economic opportunity in a more open and equal way. It's a very broad definition, right, of making our society more sustainable for everybody. And I do think this crisis will accelerate a bunch of the pillars that we put into our broad sustainability society, our broad sustainability platform. And I think it will change the allocation of capital. And that's my big point in all of this. Capital is going to shift to help make our world stronger. We are going to see capital allocation change with respect to energy to try to find ways to have a greener future. We are going to see capital allocation shift around making sure healthcare supply chains are better prepared for something like this, and also to make sure that healthcare more broadly is more accessible, more available for people around the world. We are going to see capital allocation try to make sure that opportunity improves for all and that capitalism broadly is more inclusive. And so I think this crisis accelerates that. And I think that a crisis has a tendency to accelerate trends. Now, that doesn't mean every single one of those at every single minute, but there's no question that the private sector has been focused on a transition to thinking broadly about how it can use its capital in ways that improve the sustainability of our society. And the reason they do it, that people are thinking about it, is because it's good business. If you want to take care of shareholders, you better take care of your people, and you better take care of your planet, and you better take care of your communities. And if you do that, you know, your business will be stronger and you'll perform better. And so I think that's a trend that's been in place. I think the crisis accelerates it a little bit. That doesn't mean, given some of the things that we're going to have to spend money on in the short term, that the capital allocation necessarily accelerates every pillar of that. But generally speaking, I think we all want a better, stronger world for everyone. And I think this crisis will amplify that.
I'm glad you said that, because it's very important that we're always progressing all the activities of the world that are important to the future. And so I agree with you wholeheartedly. And I'm sure the majority of us think that way in the world. So we've come up, we got a minute left. I'm going to ask you two questions. They're music related.
Sure.
I don't know all about your genres of music. I'm going to give you three names and you just tell me which one you would choose as your alignment as a DJ. So I'm going to go back first to David Morales, Frankie Knuckles, or Mike Huckabee, rest in peace. Any of those three influence your DJing style?
Wow. Well, none of them strongly influence my DJ style, but all of them are super interesting in terms of their influence in music, you know, broadly. Now, I've been interested in music, Lance, you know, forever. I was a big rock and roll guy, you know, in my younger days. My first concert, which I'll always remember as one of the most remarkable concerts I ever went to, was when I saw Led Zeppelin in 1977.
That was your first?
That was my first.
Mine was Nazareth. Okay. And I was explaining Hair of the Dog to my son-in-law the other day, who loves rock and roll. And he had heard of Nazareth. And I said, what? Razzmatazz, Hair of the Dog?
But, you know, enormous Bruce Springsteen fan to this day. But I really got interested about 10 years ago in house music, and have been producing and playing a bunch of house EDM dance mix, and having some fun with it, and especially having some fun with attaching you know, some older music to it. And so, you know, one of the things I did, I made a more modern version. I took the old Fontella Bass song from 1966, Rescue Me, and made a more modern happy house dance version. And so I'm, you know, I'm having some fun, and the good, this is a hobby. It's got more visibility, but the good news is I'm actually making some money from it. It's all going to charities, in particular addiction charities, but now I'm going to start directing some of it to charities that are helping frontline COVID workers. And so it's been a nice hobby that's turned into a nice platform that can do some good. And it's a whole lot of fun.
Good. Final question then. David Guetta, Calvin Harris, or Dizzy Rascal? Any of those align to you?
I mean, I love David Guetta. You know, Calvin Harris has written and produced some incredible music. But, you know, I think David Guetta, you know, is one of the great, you know, house dance DJs of all time. There are a bunch of them, but he's one of the great house dance DJs of all time.
Excellent. David, thank you very much for joining the CERAWeek Conversations. Your great leadership, friendship, and I appreciate getting to spend the time with you here today.
Well, it's really great to see you, Lance. I really appreciate you having me. I hope you and everyone else that's watching this is staying safe and healthy, and we will get through this, and we get through it by working together. So thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.